This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Welcome to the July 13, 2012 podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. I'm Natalie Pynchon. I will be reading a summary of some of the articles published by the JNS today. Topics covered in this podcast are traumatic brain injury, oncology, and vascular disorders. Decompressive craniectomy, a meta-analysis of influences on intracranial pressure and cerebral perfusion pressure in the treatment of traumatic brain injury. A review article by Edson Borseng Shu and colleagues. In recent years, the role of decompressive craniectomy for the treatment of patients with traumatic brain injury and refractory intracranial hypertension has been the subject of several studies. The purpose of this review was to evaluate the contribution of decompressive craniectomy in reducing intracranial pressure and increasing cerebral perfusion pressure in these patients. A comprehensive literature search was performed for articles related to the effects of decompressive craniectomy on intracranial pressure and cerebral perfusion pressure in patients with traumatic brain injury. Study inclusion criteria were 1. Published manuscripts, 2. Original articles of any study design except case reports, 3. Availability of pre- and postoperative intracranial pressure and/or cerebral perfusion pressure data. Primary outcomes were intracranial pressure decrease and/or cerebral perfusion pressure increase for assessing the efficacy of decompressive craniectomy. Secondary outcome was the persistence of reduced intracranial pressure 24 and 48 hours after the operation. Postoperative intracranial pressure values were significantly lower than preoperative values. This finding was observed immediately after and 48 hours after decompressive craniectomy. Postoperative cerebral perfusion pressure was significantly higher than preoperative values. In conclusion, decompressive craniectomy can effectively decrease intracranial pressure and increase cerebral perfusion pressure in patients with TBI and refractory elevated intracranial pressure. Further studies are necessary to define the group of patients that can benefit the most from this procedure. Ectopic recurrent craniopharyngioma of the frontal bone, a case report by Martin Jacobs and Burke Orakoglu. A 77-year-old female patient presented to the author's department with indolent swelling in the right supraorbital area. The patient had undergone transcranial bifrontal resection of adamantinomatous craniopharyngioma 16 years earlier at another hospital. The CT and MRI studies revealed that the swelling was caused by an osteolytic, partly solid, partly cystic lesion located right next to the osteosynthesis plate implanted at the craniotomy site of the primary surgery. The patient underwent total resection of this extradural lesion via a lateral eyebrow approach. Definitive histopathological assessment revealed the lesion to be an ectopic, recurrent adamantinomatous craniopharyngioma. Ectopic recurrent craniopharyngioma is a rarely described phenomenon, with only 50 cases found in the literature. Ectopic recurrence has to be differentiated from local recurrence and primary ectopic craniopharyngioma. It is thought to be caused by seed implantation of tumor cells alongside the surgical tract and by CSF contamination with tumor cells. Spreading alongside the surgical tract results most often in ectopic growth inside the frontal lobe and the epidural space, whereas CSF contamination most commonly causes ectopic growth in the posterior fossa and cerebellopontine angle. Ectopic recurrence occurs after a median time of 7 years after initial surgery. The present case is the first one in which osseous growth of ectopic recurrent craniopharyngioma is described. To monitor surgical success, the authors recommended follow-up MRI studies to their patient, who had quickly recovered from surgery. Temporal dynamics of microparticle elevation following subarachnoid hemorrhage. A laboratory investigation by Matthew Sanborn and colleagues. Microparticles are small membrane fragments that are shed from various cell types and associated with cell activation or apoptosis. Elevated levels have been implicated in thrombosis, inflammation, and endothelial dysfunction. Mounting evidence suggests that delayed cerebral injury following subarachnoid hemorrhage involves a multifactorial vasculopathy exacerbated by thrombosis and inflammation. Microparticles are uniquely situated to act as a final common pathway linking this triad. To explore the extent and time course of microparticle elevation after subarachnoid hemorrhage, blood samples were drawn on the day of hemorrhage and 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 days later from 22 patients. MRI was performed on day 14 to assess for infarction. Microparticles were identified using flow cytometry with antibody labeling used to identify the cell of origin. Initially, microparticles of all subtypes were significantly elevated. More importantly, microparticles exhibited distinct temporal profiles depending on their cell of origin. The microparticles traditionally associated with thrombosis and endothelial dysfunction, specifically those expressing CD146 and tissue factor, were elevated until at least day 10, well into the vasospasm window. Additionally, endothelial cell-derived microparticles and tissue factor-expressing microparticles were inversely associated with infarction and predicted infarction as early as day 1 after hemorrhage. Thank you for listening to the Journal of Neurosurgery. To listen to more of our podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter and now also on Facebook.